This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Kia ora, tatou, hare mai. Hello everyone and welcome to the AA Live radio show. Tonight we are exploring the ideas behind a way of recovery through the 12 Steps Alcoholics Anonymous program. Thank you for joining us from around the motu in the world this evening. It is great to have you here and I have my co-host. How are you today?
I'm very good, Jen.
Good. I'm pleased you're good. Alcoholics Anonymous is a service based on alcoholics that help each other. We work through a 12-step program with a sponsor guiding us. And our sponsor is an alcoholic, just like us. And they have a little bit more recovery time than we do. And they take us under their belt and look after us. And we support each other. And with a sponsor, you get that support. As a group, we get that support through meetings, all those fun things. And we learn how to live life without the craving of alcohol. So we learn together too that we have a disease and we're not going crazy. And on that note of crazy, I'm going to say hello to my co-host. How are you this evening?
I don't know if I like the sound of that on the note of crazy. I'm really good, Jen. Thanks very much.
Good. I know many of us. We did. I thought I was going a bit crazy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, that constant craving for alcohol.
Yeah.
Coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous has stopped that for me. I'm incredibly, incredibly lucky. So, yeah, it works. That's all I can say from my experience. One day at a time. So, we're going to get on to the show. At each meeting, we start with the Serenity Prayer, the Karakia, and we have the preamble that explains what Alcoholics Anonymous is sort of as a whole. So, let's start there tonight. Take it away, Sean.
God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Beautifully done. I started to button do it with you, but then I thought, actually, no, it sounds really good, just you. What are we on to now? Oh, preamble.
Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, so that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
That's us. It's pretty good. Is it working for you?
It is working for me.
Nice.
Actually, I was thinking about that just today, and yes, it is definitely working for me.
Excellent. And now, look, folks, I just want to warn you that the opinions that come out this evening from Sean and myself and our people that we're interviewing and all those fun things, what you hear, it's just our opinions. That is not those of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. It's just us with our thoughts, sharing them with you. Aren't you so lucky?
Indeed.
Anyway, I had a bit of a sugar rush before I came here today.
No.
Anyway, it's all about recovering alcoholics, getting together. We discuss, you know, our different aspects of recovery. And occasionally we read a bit of literature that's available to us from the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And in that note, we are going to do the daily reflection. Sean, take it away.
The daily reflection for October 17th is titled, A Daily Tune-Up. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. That's from page 85 of Alcoholics Anonymous. How do I maintain my spiritual condition? For me, it's quite simple. On a daily basis, I ask my higher power to grant me the gift of sobriety for that day. I have talked to many alcoholics who have gone back to drinking, and I always ask them, did you pray for sobriety the day that you took your first drink? Not one of them said yes. As I practiced step 10 and try to keep my house in order on a daily basis, I have the knowledge that if I ask for a daily reprieve, it will be granted.
That's so true. You know, strangely enough, this morning when I was driving off in the car after dropping my son at school, I said, oh, I haven't done my handover. I've got to do it. And I was driving down the road saying it out loud. And I thought, because every day, you know, I ask for that reprieve. Yeah. And it's strange how it has become a habit in my life. But one I can still forget, of course. I mean, you know, occasionally life gets too busy. But yeah, it makes me feel more empowered to get through my day. Do you hand over each day?
I do. And well, not only the sort of handing over myself to my higher power, but also, I mean, there's the whole. I've come to do just a morning ritual, which then that's part of it, and then other parts of it are reading the reflections and just doing. Having a little bit of meditation time. So it's a whole sort of a ritual that kind of gets me in the right headspace for the day. But I think with that reflection, the thing I really liked about it, well, there were the two things, was that, as you're mentioning, you know, the handing yourself over to your higher power, which I think is so powerful because it sort of just gives you a strength that, you know, it's just not something, it goes beyond what you can do yourself. But also the other part of that reflection that I really liked was, the fact that you're just doing it day to day. It's one day at a time. And it's, you know, and when you think about things in those terms, it's a lot more manageable to, you know, I mean, if I think I'm not going to drink for 10 years, I mean, that's a little bit overwhelming for me to consider, you know.
Absolutely.
But if I think I'm not going to drink today, I can do that. I know I can do that. And I know with the help of my higher power, I will do that. So yeah. It's just, you know, you just take little bites, you know, you don't. If that makes sense.
It does make sense, heaps of sense. Because I remember before I walked into the rooms of AA, I was like, oh, how can I possibly live life without my friend alcohol? The whole idea of, and of course, my head was jumping forward to, yeah. You know, 10 years, yeah. Christmas, you know, anything, yeah. Because it was a daily thing. It's like, how could I possibly survive? So, I think that one day at a time is so important.
It's key.
It's key.
One day at a time and the help from your higher power to do that. You know, those are...
Well, last night I was at a meeting and I heard some wonderful sharing from people. But one of the things that stood out, and it came from two people who I respect highly, I respect their sobriety highly, and... they both mentioned that they hadn't met a person yet that had gone out and done some more research with the bottle and that life had got better for them.
How could it, really?
Yeah. You know? And it made me think actually quite a bit today, how much different life is for me. Yeah. And it is just something I never – it's as better than I thought it was going to be. There's nobody goes out and picks up again and has a good time, I don't think, now.
I don't think so at all. I mean, for me, the way it got, there was nothing fun about alcohol anymore at all. And if I started drinking again, I would bypass the fun altogether. I know that deep inside, you know, I know that.
That's one of the things they teach us, isn't it? That's one of the things we learn, I should say, is that when we pick up again, we start straight back where we were. It's not like having that first drink and going, oh, this is the elixir I've been waiting for all my life. I can do anything on this.
Right.
No, it's back to that dark, horrible place.
Immediately, yeah. yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's something that took us years to get to can happen, overnight sort of thing.
Yeah.
Frightening.
It is.
Well, you are listening to the AA Live Show in association with our friends from Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. Now, Sean has picked us a wonderful song today, "Atoms for Peace." That is the band. We're going to kick it off and see what goes on. just talking then about that band, Atoms for Peace, and it's made up of Tom York from Radiohead and Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Thank you, Sean, for bringing that in. He's always teaching me something. This month we're bringing you the story from Peter. Now, when this was recorded, Tony helped out with this one, and he went out and he visited Peter in his house. And I need you to picture this while you listen. The two of them are sitting there in Peter's house, which is a little bit like a castle, an old castle. They're in a couple of comfortable chairs, just these two men sitting there. The fire's roaring. They've had a beautiful, scrumptious meal that Peter cooked, and they're just having this really relaxed chat about Peter's story. It's nice. Pretty cool, yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it was peaceful. What did he say? It was just, yeah, it was, I know Tony said he felt really uplifted afterwards.
Very
about,
cool.
Yeah, sharing it, and he was pretty honoured to be in Peter's company for the evening. So I hope you feel the same after hearing it. I've put it into two parts, so we're going to go with part one now.
Hello, my name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm here to share my story with you, story of my life, in about 20, 25 minutes. I was born in England in the 50s, just 10 years after the end of the war. And I still remember how black London looked in those days, how sooty it was, and really how poor, I guess, England still was. But I was born to, I guess you call them bohemian parents. My father was a literary critic. My mother was a actress when they met. When I say bohemian, they were well educated and artistic leanings. But they didn't, it wasn't as though they were partying and staying up all night in cafes, which is the other side of bohemianism. I think they were really eminently respectable in terms of their behavior. More about that later. But my father ended up being a university man, got himself a position in the universities in the 50s, beginning in Glasgow, and then moving to Africa and back to England, and then to the United States. And finally, we ended up in Canada when I was about 10 years old. So I guess it was a kind of a marriage of the Englishness of my mother and the Americanness of my father. And I think I had always thought that I'd had a very happy childhood. You know, I kind of came and I had a few very early glimmerings of memory, but I really came into consciousness living in Africa with the wonderful sights and smells and sounds and feel of the tropics and the sea bathing in the beach and the gardens but that was probably only for about 18 months, and my mother returned to the to England with myself and my two brothers, and my mother was a very loving, attentive mother. And so the story was that we'd come back to England for the children's education. But as I look back at those, what my English education was, what schools in England were like at the time, that story doesn't really hold water because the schools were terrible. And I just kind of survived them. Sitting there in a daydream, hoping that, you know, I wasn't one of the ones who were going to get whacked. really what had happened is my mother and father had separated. But in those days, well, one didn't discuss anything emotional with children, but also maintaining appearances in England was very important, I think. And so I knew that there was something wrong with the family, but I didn't really know what it was. But I did begin from quite an early age myself to begin concealing things as well. I think I must have understood that life was really a process of concealing things. And so I did begin having a secret life as a child with things that I didn't tell anybody about. And once I'd borrowed a friend's air gun and shot a blackbird in the breast and watched it die while I was hiding. I remember some people coming along and seeing this bird and going, "Oh, look at this bird." And I was hiding in the bushes with my air gun or my borrowed air gun. And so that kind of experience, I didn't tell anybody about. And you know, there's this, I guess just my concealment is indicative of that secret life, which becomes important later on. We arrived in Canada when I was 11 years old, and so that was my first experience of immigrating to a country. And there, too, you know, I had the need to fit in. And again, that's a kind of a denying of myself and a sort of pretending that the English part, you know, didn't exist and trying to become as Canadian as possible, as quickly as possible. And we lost our English accents very quickly in this wanting to fit in. There was something else going on as well. But my father had rejoined us by this time for the move to Canada. But there was a great deal of fighting between my mother and father, taking the form usually of just loud verbal argument. There wasn't physical abuse, but there was just a continual emotional or continual putting down, disparaging of my mother in front of the children and to her face. When I look back now, it's just it seems unbelievable that kind of behavior. I mean, times have changed, of course. I've read books in which I've heard this practice modeled as well. So it may have even been fairly accepted culturally then. Anyway, it was. That might have been one thing that led to me at quite an early age of spending a lot of time outside the house. So I took to relationships with other boys very quickly and ended up spending all my time, even though my mother and father were both gainfully employed in the 60s, which meant we had a high standard of living and could have done anything, you know, could have had any sort of educational privileges. I chose to hang out with other boys, usually on the other side of the tracks, not in the nice neighborhood, but in the poorer neighborhoods, down by the tracks where the kids were sniffing glue, hanging out outside in all kinds of weather. Why did I want to be away from home so much? I know, in hindsight, maybe could be said that it was because there was this, in some ways, there wasn't a home there. The home was there, certainly on the surface, and my mother and my father would have been happy to kind of sit down with me and listen to me and talk to me had I gone to them, but it didn't occur to me to go to them. And I guess it didn't really occur to them to come to me. And there were, so there were no boundaries at all. From age about 12, I'd never brought a book home from school. I wasn't, in fact, my whole school life was an absolute waste of time, I think, because I never did any homework, and I just daydreamed my way through the day at school. And there was no parental kind of discipline around this. And as I got older, into 15, 16, I began skipping school all the time, playing hooky, days and days on end, hanging out at the pool hall. And when this all came to light in the end, I remember my father did come into the school. But when we got home, there was no talking to, there was no, this kind of, you know, later on, I think, okay, we'll get in, let's take a little break. I'm going to have a, pull my thoughts together and return. Yeah, so I've been left sitting here thinking about this question that comes up sometimes. Why am I an alcoholic? Or what has happened to me? What's gone on in my life? And one thing I need to talk about is the shame that I have felt as a result of my alcoholism. And I bring it up at this point because I can recall when I was 11, 12 years old and we'd moved to Canada, and my father had got a job at the university. We had an expensive house in the nicest area of the city, and I just had this feeling that we were rich, and I didn't need to do anything again. I could just sit back and put my feet up. I could just coast, which is what happened. Never tried in school. Spent all my time simply hanging out with friends, and as time went on, using alcohol and drugs, because that was, you know, part of what when you hung out on the street, what you did. So it's my that's all my responsibility. You know, I was the one that didn't do anything, and that made these choices toward a life of dissipation. At the same time, you know, I recognize now that something had happened in my family that had set me up for this kind of behavior. Could that have been living in a serious a situation of serious abuse happening, in other words, living in a family that, or a relationship that wasn't really a relationship, and between my brothers and myself, there was no, we seemed to lose any kind of relationship, or a relationship just in name, perhaps a deep biological connection, but. But we began to reflect, I think, this abuse as well, and in the culture of the times, the street culture that I grew up in, when I was outside the house, it was misogynistic, it was violent, fighting was common, crime was common. I participated in all of these things. And so, you know, from the years 16, 18, 20, it was, a descent, a rapid descent. And by the time I was 18 years old, I understood that I was an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic. But, you know, there was no help there. My parents, bless them, allowed us to sit down in the basement of the house doing all kinds of things. You know, these street drugs, there's nothing new about these street drugs. Crystal methadrine was quite common in the society that I grew up in. And so the injecting of crystal methadrine was something I experienced at an early age. My elder brother was a bona fide drug addict by the time he was 18 years old, and participating in the criminal drug addicted underworld. And there just seemed to be nothing to stop it. There was nothing arresting it, and it just continued. And so there I was I had become ill. I had become addicted. I was an alcoholic, and so that has its own. From then on, that has its own. You know, it has its own logic. I had to be drunk as often as I could be, and I had to follow whatever stumble from one situation to another. That was the logic of my life. And you know, I had quit school, and I began traveling around taking jobs like working on fishing boats and working on the oil rigs, when I was 25 by this time, I was working in the Canadian Arctic, and I had on a summer job, and I had a phone call to say that my mother came on the phone in tears to say that my elder brother was dead. And she said, "We're telling everyone it's a diving accident." Again, this, you know, covering up the truth. Why do you have to, you know, why are you still trying to maintain some? But I suppose if you're English, it dies hard. You know, the concealing was life or death, I suppose, at one time. But my brother committed suicide with an overdose of barbiturates, age 26. And I continued drinking. I continued drinking for perhaps two more years, during which time it became much worse. I was out on the west coast of Canada, and the combination of alcohol and psilocybin mushrooms produced a kind of permanent inebriated psychotic state in me, in which I could, I was living in this kind of colorful hallucinatory world, and I could sort of maintain that state. But of course, at the cost of going downhill very quickly, in terms of you know, people not wanting me to have anything to do with me, so ending up you know, having friendships with people in back alleys in the middle of the night, other drunks like myself. One evening there, I had a six pack of beer with me, and I was in a back alley, and quite a smart car pulled up, a sports car. I think it was a Corvette. And the guy said something out the window. And anyway, I picked up a bottle of beer and threw it. I was just, you know, what I was trying to, I was offering them a beer. I said, "Here, catch." I threw them a beer, but they were one of those quite heavy bottles, and it hit the roof of the car, which was just above the door, was a sort of a glass, plexiglass roof. And anyway, so there was the cops ended up there, and I ended up, you know, I had been overnight in jail before, but It was another one of those situations in a court case afterwards for mischief. But this kind of, you know, being out on the loose in the night was becoming quite common for me. That was where my alcohol had taken me. I had a blanket rolled up with a piece of string around it over my shoulder. My hair was long and frizzy. My face was bright red with cuts on it. I was looking like a Skid Row bum at the age of 27. And it could be quite a long story what happened from then on, but I suddenly realized something about the nature of my condition, and it happened when a couple of friends visited me in this room I was staying in, a guy and his girlfriend who I'd introduced them a year or two before, and I was in my room that had a mattress in it and not much else, you know, everything that I'm sort of scattered around in a littered mess around the bed. And I remember them saying to me, "Peter, we liked you better the way you were before." And I said, "Before? What?" He said, "Oh yeah, you know, when we were sort of hanging out and playing music." And that had been a couple of years before. And that was when I had not descended so far. I was doing a little better. And I thought about this for a minute, and I realized that in my psychotic state, I had thought that I was doing better than ever, when really the reverse was true.
All right, we're going to have a little break at the moment between that, and we'll have some music, and we're going to have some Lord. God, a bit of Kiwi coming through. Go for it.
Enough of us. explosions on TV, and all the girls with heads inside a dream. So now we live beside the pool where everything is good.
A bit of Lord. Hey? You are listening to the AA Live radio show in association with our friends on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. And we're going to return to Peter's story and let him finish, you know, in peace. Okay, enjoy listening to this one.
So a moment of clarity descended upon me, and it took the form of my suddenly realizing that my father was actually not all wrong about everything, and that I was wrong about just about everything, particularly about who I was and what I was doing. There was absolutely nothing redeeming in my behavior. You know, I try to make up fantasies about myself to make myself kind of feel better, but a moment of lucidity meant I could see through all that. And so it was very shaking, and it was enough of a shake-up for me to, the next morning, to cross the Cambie Bridge from downtown Vancouver, turn left on West Broadway, go down half a block, and go into a storefront, an old storefront, and find this man sitting beside a desk. It looked a bit like a lawyer's office, like an old-fashioned lawyer's office with a big brown desk. An elderly gentleman in a suit in an armchair behind the desk with portraits on the wall behind him. How did I know that office was there? That was the office of Alcoholics Anonymous in Vancouver. You don't have, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't really have offices. There are a few around the world, but for the most part, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous meets in church basements. I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18. A friend brought home all the people from the bar when it closed, and a guy sat around and picked up the guitar and played very well, and then began talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and what a good organization it was and how nice the people were. So that seed had been planted, but I hadn't really given any other thought since a night 10 years previously. So how I knew that office was there, I don't know. How I knew to cross the Cambie Bridge, turn left on Broadway, I don't know. But I ended up in that office. I knew where to go. And he pushed a big book across the desk to me, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and said, "When did you have your last drink?" And in tears, I said, "I scraped together enough money, loose change, to buy a couple of beers last night." He said, "Okay." He said, in a minute or two, we're going to walk down the street. There's a meeting. There's a meeting starts at 12 o'clock. And he got up from behind the desk, came out, and we walked together down this brightly lit in the spring of 82 in Vancouver into this sort of a drop-in center, little restaurant with several tables and people sitting around the tables. And he left me there. And hanging up on the wall of this room were the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of AA, two banners with the steps and the traditions. And there was a guy across the table on the other side of the table to me, and he was a sort of middle-aged guy, and he looked a bit thin and a bit I don't know. But he had a little bit old, and he had his arms on the table, and he was laying his head down on the table and resting his head on the table. And I thought, and nobody was saying anything or even kind of noticing the guy. And I was looking around thinking, and it just occurred to me that people here, they don't care, they don't mind who I might be, how I might be behaving. There's something else going on here. Appearances don't appear to be very important in this place. And so that was one of my first intimations that that I could be in a place where I didn't have to act, where I could be in a place where I could be myself. And that is essentially what I had done that day. I had gotten out of my own way, and somehow I had come into a new life which was truer and more real and more me than anything I had experienced since my childhood. So that was 1982, and I began the road of recovery from alcoholism. There is a solution. There is an answer. There's a treatment program. There is a way out of alcoholism, and I'm very fortunate that somehow it seemed almost in spite of me, I found it. I found it. So I think there's a few minutes left. I wish I had another hour to talk about what that recovery has entailed and what it's like. For me, it's been long, continuous. I have decades of without having touched alcohol. I haven't had a drink since 1982. It's been everything that everyone said it might be, and probably a lot more as well. You know, I've done things that I could have never imagined that I'd be doing. You know, every 10 years or so, it feels like my life is completely renewed, and I would be doing something that I never would have dreamt I'd be doing 10 years before. And so let's deal a little bit with this terrible sense of shame that I alluded to earlier. And I talked about my face having become very red. That's partially alcohol, but it's also a burning up with shame. And it was one of the main things I've had to deal with through my recovery. And it came, I suppose, a lot from that knowledge that it was me when I was 12 years old that decided I didn't have to do anything anymore, that there were no rules and no boundaries. I could do whatever I wanted. And it just led me to not growing up, to being, to remaining a child, to feeling like a child in a grown-up world, and to have to hide this from everybody and pretend to be grown up when I wasn't really. And so I had to begin to, I had to deal with that shame. And I think part of recovery is going back and understanding. You know, it wasn't until years later that I figured out that there was a lot of emotional abuse going on in my family of origin. It was recovery that gave me the skills of introspection to look at my family situation and to understand that had set me up for something. And in doing that, I began to see that it wasn't my fault. I know I have responsibility for the choices that I made, but my elder brother was a drug addict who killed himself. My younger brother has had a life of depression and still suffers with that. May have problems with drugs and alcohol. It's not for me to say. It's we sort of stick to our own case, and we learn that the name alcoholic applies to me in this program. It's not for me to give to other people. But so how, you know, why did that all happen? How come all three of us? And so, you know, I think now, I think probably with just about all of us, we were going to be alcoholics and there's nothing we could do about it. And by the time we were alcoholics, we're under the power of something that we cannot change, that we're powerless over, and that's taken us on this ride to hell. That's addiction, and that's the illness. Someday I hope to come back and talk all about the wonders of recovery, everything that has happened, the opening up of the world in a very deep, a very rich, an amazingly satisfying way, and experiencing all this at the same time as still being an addict, because although I didn't want to be an addict, and it's an illness, and I became an addict, and there is a recovery from it, the other side of that is that I know I'm always an addict as well, and that recovery is a daily reprieve, contingent upon my following the principles of recovery. So a constant awareness, a constant examination of my choices, an attempt to live according to, let's say, less self-concerned and less selfish principles. You know, the idea of becoming part of a community, perhaps a spiritual community, of raising my consciousness to be less concerned with myself and more concerned with others. All places that all realms that that continue to unfold and open up before me. And the last thing I'll say is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we occasionally have, you know, we have meetings almost every night of the week in Dunedin, and we get to, but we also get to have regional conferences, and when I'm traveling, I go to, you know, I'm part of the wider recovery community. And of course, on the internet these days, there's an endless, unlimited recovery community. But at one of these gatherings here in Dunedin, I met a man from Auckland, and he'd been a businessman. I think he'd done quite well at one time, but he was now old, and his business had, it was a thing of the past. I think it disappeared. I don't know if it went bankrupt, but he was reduced to a very simple form of life. And he said, you know, I've got a roof over my head, and I've got enough to eat. I've got a place to sleep. He said, it's all I need, and I'm happy with it. And it looked like he must have also had enough money for the plane fare to Dunedin, but nevertheless, that has stuck with me. That the hope and the encouragement from that, you know, the fact that I can be like I was when I was 12. Really, I can put my feet up to some extent. Don't have to worry about succeeding in life, because it's not about having a. It's not about the material life now. The happiness and the peace will come from the spiritual life, and that is the education that Alcoholics Anonymous is giving.
Did you enjoy that story, Sean?
I did, yes, that was good.
Yeah, I think we should definitely get him back to talk a bit more about his recovery. So that's, you know, I think he'd have some interesting stuff to say. All right, I'd like to remind you all that there are no membership fees to join AA. All you need to do is turn up to a meeting and discover what it's all about. Check out our website on aa.org.nz to see where and when there is a meeting in your area. It is full of information, that website. Remember, folks, if you want to drink, that is your business. If you want to stop, well, the 12-step program could be for you. You can get in touch with us by calling 0800 AA Works. That's 0800 229 6757. Or you can jump on aaotago.org.nz. You can even post us a letter. When was the last time you got a letter, Sean?
I was just thinking, I only get bills in the post.
Yes, same. Those Williams. You can send us a letter to P.O. Box 6115, Dunedin North, Dunedin 9059. So once again, I'll tell you that website, aa.org.nz. Now, Sean and I were talking just earlier about a person that we both highly regard. And Sean just wanted to, you know, sort of say something about this person.
Thanks, Jen. Yeah, I just wanted to take a quick moment to just give a shout out to Mike, who's Mike's a guy that I'll be seeing him tonight at my Wednesday night meeting, and he's been there since I started going to Wednesday night meetings, and I think of him as a rock. He's a very solid guy, and he's been a real inspiration for me and something to aspire to. And I think he's been sober, what is it, 25, 27 years?
More, I think. I think it's more, yeah. He's got a good good amount of time behind him.
I knew it was a long time. I didn't know the exact number, but he's just, and still, after all that time, like I say, he's an inspiration for someone like me who's, you know, just over 1 year sober. And he's moving, actually, is why I bring it up, is because he's moving out of Dunedin. And so tonight is his last meeting at our Wednesday night meeting. So I just wanted to say hi and bye to Mike. And I hope everything goes great with your move. And thanks for, I'm happy that you've come into my life, so. That's nice.
Thanks for the inspiration. Mike actually came in and did a show here with me. We had a great time. I enjoyed it anyway. He brought some great music. So, listeners, if you fancy hearing Mike's story, I'm trying to remember when it was, and my long COVID brain is telling me something about 6 months, maybe. Anyway, it's Mike's story. You'll see it on the podcast details there. Yeah, interesting man. A good man, too,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank Peter for sharing his story with us tonight. It was very inspiring. And thank Tony for taking the time to catch up with Peter and sit in that relaxed environment. And thank you, Sean, for co-hosting with me tonight.
It's my pleasure, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And to our listeners out there, a big thank you for spending your evening out there with us. Across the motu, the world, we are very grateful to have you there. And we're grateful too for the opportunity to share our experiences of strength and hope with you. So we enjoy the fact you're there. So please keep coming back. That's what we say at the end of every meeting.
That's right.
So, take care of yourselves out there, and until next time, Matiwa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.